Now it's a true joy to be speaking with Midjour. Thanks so much for joining me on the show.
That's a pleasure.
Now, I've already been playing some of the tracks of your excellent new studio album entitled Fragile. Now, this is the first collection of new music from you, aside from Ultravox's brilliant album Brilliant and a few live CDs. Why did you decide this was the year to release a completely new album?
Well, before it became a posthumous album, it was time to get it finished. I went through over the kind of 10-11 years since my last new music album. I went through a lot of phases of working on it and not working on it and thinking that I couldn't write any songs anymore, and then, thinking, well, maybe I can write songs, but maybe nobody wants to hear them. Do I want to be part of the music industry as it stands right now, because it's changed so much over the years. Mm. And then I kind of got my act together and just thought, you know what, finish what you're doing. You can't compete against what you might consider, a lot of as, mediocre. Mm. If you just hold your hands up and run away from it. So the only way you can compete is to go out there and make something that you think is interesting, that you think the music industry needs more of. And that's exactly what I did. So this year, 3 months ago, I hadn't planned on finishing it yet, but I finished it all quite quickly, and I'm very pleased with the results.
Yes, fantastic. I'm so glad you did. I'm so glad you went ahead with it, because I know millions of fans are going to be so excited by it.
Well, the thing is, everything's changed since the last time I put a new album out, because, you get instant feedback from people on, Facebook and Twitter and all the social media things. So, the buzz that's going around about the album right now is fantastic. It's really good, because people don't just soft soap you, they let you know in no uncertain terms, whether they like something or not, be it a concert or a performance or a TV show or something you've said in the papers or whatever, they let you know instantly. Yes. But the feedback on the album has been fabulous.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful album, I love it. I mean, despite some collaborations with Moby, this really is what could be termed a completely solo album. I mean, insofar as you've produced, you've engineered, you've arranged and played almost everything in the studio. Is this the first time you've ever done all that with one album, and how did it feel to do that?
It's the first time I've done it to this level. Literally it was me in the studio. There was no one else. I had no engineer, no producer, no sidekick, no real other musicians. In fact, no other musicians were in the studio. The only people who appear on that, there's a drummer who appears on one track, who sent me a drum loop that he recorded at his home. Mm-hmm. And of course the track that I collaborated with Moby on, where he sent me a track from his then home in New York that he had recorded, and I kind of put it into my system and added to it and chopped it up and did all of that. So nobody actually appeared in my studio at all, so it really was an insular process. But I've never done it to that extent with previous albums. I've done a lot of things before, but there's always been someone else around that you can gauge, by their feedback as to whether what you're doing is any good or not.
Yes. Did you find that quite freeing, or did you feel a little bit sort of like, oh, I wonder how it's going to be received in the end?
A bit of both. Mm. I quite enjoyed the process of doing it in this kind of blinkered fashion, because I decided that when I was making this album, because of where I was and what I was doing and what was going on in my life, that I should be absolutely honest and brutally real about writing, about what I was saying in the songs, and when you do that, you have to be in a kind of insular place. It's very difficult singing or saying something or trying to evoke a certain emotion when you've got half a dozen people all sitting looking at you. Yeah. I suppose it must be like an actor, doing a sex scene in a movie. It's meant to be intimate and all of that. And of course, there's 20 people holding lights and pointing cameras at you. Yeah. It's a very difficult thing to do. So to do it properly, I thought, I've got to be completely on my own.
Mm. You've got to be within yourself and then
I
to go
so, yeah.
out of yourself afterwards. Yeah. I mean, would you say that this album's sort of been influenced in some way by your excellent work with Visage, Ultravox, Rich Kids and Thin Lizzy?
I think there's no doubt that all of that stuff comes out in what you do, because we all are the culmination of our influences, of what we experience and what we read and what movies we see and what people we meet and, you know, and little bits of knowledge and little bits of you know, melody and stuff that come and stick with us, because we're all born like sponges, you know. We all go through life, you know, hearing something, seeing something, reading something that only you have read, and by the time you get to create your own thing, by the time you get to do your own output, you know, you've absorbed a different amounts of those things, but different from everybody else.
Yes.
So it makes you the individual you are. So when it comes to making an album, I'm 60 years old now, and it comes to making an album like Fragile,
yeah,
I can hear and see influences that I've had for 40 years, for 50 years, you know, all the way through this music. Maybe it might not be predominant to everybody else, but to me it's there. You know, I can hear bits of the British blues boom, I can hear bits of Thin Lizzy, certainly the guitar playing, and you know, I can hear the textures and ambience of, you know, Brian Eno or Roxy Music or David Bowie, or, you know, all of that stuff all kind of permeates through what you do, and that's what makes you an individual. Having said that, if you played a track on the radio and someone didn't know what the track was, but they knew the sound of my voice, they would be able to tell it was me because of, yes, the melodies and the structure and the style of the music.
Yes, it's undeniably you, isn't it? But as you said, I mean, you can only really write about experiences you've had, and every part of that journey, that process of songwriting, it's at one given time, isn't it? You know,
it is. If you're going to be real about it, you know, I don't have to sit down and invent little scenarios to write about, you know, a boy meets girl and trucks down the highway on a, you know, mm-hmm, in a soft-top limousine, you know, whatever, mm-hmm, it happens to be. I don't have to do that, and I've never really been one for that. So I think maybe as the years go on, and I've tried to describe this as like a diary. You know, you write down your emotions, your feelings, and what's good in your life at that moment and what's bad in your life at that moment. And you try and put it in a palatable sense, so that it makes some kind of linear sense. Because I believe that someone somewhere will hear one of those tracks and think, you know what, that song's about me. That song's, yeah, about my life, because, yeah, that's what I'm going through right now.
Yeah.
And that's what music should kind of do to you. It should provoke an emotion. It should make you feel that you've been wrapped in a warm blanket, or it should make you cry, or it should make you happy, or it should make you dance. It should provoke some kind of emotion. And right now we're going through a phase where, if you look at the big artists, a lot of the big artists in the world, and look at the songwriting credits, they're written by a team. They're written by 20 people, you know.
Yes.
So it's like, it's manufactured. It's music by committee.
Yeah.
It's manufactured music to try and make you buy the music, as opposed to listening to one person or one artist, one band's, yeah, collective ideas.
That is such an interesting way, and so perceptive way of looking at it. But so true. I mean, talking of music that makes you feel something, I mean, Ultravox, Vienna, I just, dancing with tears in your eyes, it just does so much to me. It's fantastic. I mean, it's such a fantastic song. And the video, of course, was inspired by The Third Man. I mean, were you aware you were creating such a cutting-edge look and sound at the time?
We knew we were doing something that was different, just as we knew we were doing something different with the music. You know, there's a wonderful thing that, you know, in hindsight, you can look back and think, what made us go and write something like that? Because it was so odd at the time. It's okay looking back and thinking, well, it was obviously going to be a hit record, Vienna. No, it wasn't. It was the antithesis of what people were listening to at the time. It was too long. It sped, mm-hmm, up in the middle. It slows down at the end. It's electronic with a viola solo. You know, it just didn't fit any of the format. So when it came to making the videos, you know, we insisted that we actually took out a bank loan to make the video, because the record company wouldn't do it. They didn't see the point. They said, the record's already number two. What's a video going to do? We said, well, you know, we've got this idea, and we shot we got the bank loan, and we shot the video on, you know, 16 millimeter film, not video. We cropped the screen top and bottom to make it look like CinemaScope. You know, with the shadows and the cobbles, we had the, you know, it was black and white. It was very film noir. And it wasn't until after we did that we realized that a lot of that influence would have come from movies like The Third Man. But of course, it changed everything. Once other artists saw that video, they all said, I want one of those, you know, and I need one of those for my record. So it kind of revolutionized how people, you know, perceived music. Up until then, it was something you listened to.
Mm.
And then with videos like that and the advent of things like MTV, It was an audio visual experience.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, definitely. It was the whole package, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I mean, you've always been such an innovator, and you know, you've masterminded the great Ultravox, and also a founder of Band Aid and Live 8 with a single that sold 3.7 million. You know, Do They Know It's Christmas? I mean, you've changed the lives of so many children and adults in Africa. I mean, does that song still make you feel proud?
Yeah, I don't see how you can't be proud of it. You know, I've been misquoted many times as saying it was the worst song I've ever written. you know, it's not the best, but it's not. It was an odd song because there is no real chorus to it. It was something that was a collaboration that could only happen once. I can't imagine Bob and I ever sitting down and writing anything together again. But it was an odd combination, but a combination that worked. And the song, although it wasn't the greatest song in the world, the record was fabulous because it achieved everything that you've just said. And in a weird way, the song now has gotten better. It seems to have grown up a bit, you know, because it's all embroiled in the, you know, very essence of who we are and what we do.
Yes.
It's such a British thing. It's such a, you know, it's a British record. It's not an American thing. It's totally British. It was, you know, it was made in the same vein as, you know, Vienna or, you know, any of the songs from around that, you know, early 80s period.
Yeah.
It was electronic, it was atmospheric, and it had all of those things. So it had a real British stamp to it, and we should all be proud of that.
Definitely. I mean, it really touches your heart, and it's like a little magic moment that just everything just comes together. Everybody's just literally singing from the same song sheet, as they say, but literally just everyone wanted to do that, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And the weird thing today is that, you know, when you're walking around the supermarket and, you know, September or October, whenever they start playing Christmas records and the record comes on, that opening clang, and the, you know, it's the hair on the back of your neck stands up. It still does its job. It's just incredible.
It's amazing. And like you said, it's interesting in the world of music how one thing leads to another, because I believe you were playing with Ultravox on the show The Tube, and the seeds of the idea came to Bob, and you sort of ran with it from there. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I was on The Tube with, of course, Paula was co-hosting the show with Jules, and you know, Bob and I had known each other for a long time, and we had the conversation on the phone there. He had just seen the first footage shown on BBC television. I hadn't seen the footage at the time, so I was kind of reticent, saying, "Well, yeah, I'm busy, Bob. You know, what do you mean? You know, Ethiopia? You know, I don't quite understand." Of course, you know, within a few hours of talking to him, I saw the same footage, and of course, we met up when I got back to London, and we discussed what we could do, and we figured out nothing. You know, we were not capable of doing anything other than writing a song, other than making a record and trying to get our friends to get involved and try and get a Christmas number one where we could maybe generate £100,000. And then, of course, the rest is, it went on to do, you know, this phenomenal thing.
It's just amazing, isn't it? But like you said, all pooling together, you know, you did such a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand you were also an ambassador for Save the Children. Would you say that work holds a special place for you in your heart as music?
I think it does. You know, there's no doubt that once you've been there and you've been to Africa, and I went out with the first emergency shipment of goods that the Band Aid money bought. Because if Bob or I didn't go, the cameras didn't go, and because there was new news, you know, what we were doing was old news at this point, and new news was round the corner. So if we didn't go, the cameras wouldn't go, therefore it wouldn't be in people's faces, therefore the money would stop rolling in. So I went out there, and of course once you've been there and you've tasted it and seen it and experienced it for yourself, it kind of gets in your system, and you can't just walk away from it. You know, our initial thoughts were Band-Aid was going to be a six-month project, and it's 30 years this year. Oh. You know, we're coming up to the 30th anniversary. And that is just something we didn't foresee at all. Maybe if we had seen that further down the line, we might not have done it. I don't know. But, you know, once you're there and you're involved in it, you cannot walk away from it. So Save the Children have asked me on numerous occasions to go out there and see what some of the investment from the Band-Aid money has actually done, you know, the difference that it's made. And I was reticent to go, I have to say. I haven't been the first time. I wasn't cut out to experience that. And when they approached me about going, I really prevaricated, and they said, no, you'll see a lot of positive stuff.
That's good.
I went out and I saw the difference that it made. I met the difference that people putting their hand in their pocket and buying that record had made.
Yeah.
You know, I saw kids who were now, you know, young students and you know, teachers and you know, who were in the aid camps back in 1984. So it was a big difference.
Oh, absolutely! It just touches your heart, doesn't it? I mean, it's just incredible to see what your work has done. Really, it's just amazing.
Well, our work pales into total insignificance when you see the people out there who dedicate their lives to making the change, and they're the heroes.
Yeah, there's a lot of heroes. I mean, talking of heroes, in your song, you know, If I Was, you know, a soldier, and so many different things, it kind of got me thinking with that number one song there. You know, aside from training as an engineer, have you ever considered another career at any time?
No. You know, I've considered walking away from music many times, but I don't know what I'd do. You know, I'm not skilled at anything other than even it's a grey area as to whether I'm skilled at that or not. But the only thing I know is music and all the periphery that music entails. You know, I've thought in the past, the only other thing that I actually quite enjoy doing, I enjoy cooking. But I don't think I could put up with, you know, being in the kitchen with some chef screaming at me all the time, or worse still, me being a chef screaming at someone else. And I always thought, well, wouldn't it be great making something? Wouldn't it be great if you were a carpenter and you could build things with your hands? I mean, that would be a nice thing to do.
Yes.
It sounds quite a therapeutic and creative thing to do.
Absolutely. So that'd be Midge's Meals coming up now.
Midge's Meals, there we go.
There you go, a little concept on the radio today. Fantastic. Well, it is still creation, but of course songwriting is so creative, isn't it?
Well, it's you know, it really is some like a form of therapy. It's, you know, I can exorcise my ghosts by writing it there and putting it in music, and once it's out there, hopefully it kind of leaves you a bit. It's kind of discarding stuff, you know, good and bad.
Yeah.
Get it out there and get on, empty the vessel and get on with, you know, filling up again with new experiences.
Exactly. That's a lovely way to do it, isn't it? I mean, music evolves so much and band members move around a lot. I mean, you've worked with Phil Lynott, Bay City Rollers, writers Glenn Matlock. Have you always liked moving around and exploring sort of different genres?
Well, it kind of looks like that on paper, but it's not. That's not really how it happens. You know, when you get your first crack at making a record, you really have no say. I didn't have any say in what it was we were recording. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, you know, making a record back in the mid-70s that sounded like the Bay City Rollers, because it was played by the same people who played the Bay City Rollers records. You know, so, you know, you do that, and you're naive, and you think, well, you know, I'll be able to grow into doing my own thing. Of course you can't. So you're tarred with a brush, and you cannot get away from that. So you start all over again. I was lucky enough to start with the Rich Kids and move to London from Glasgow, where I'm from. And of course, during the Rich Kids, I bought a synthesizer, and that broke the band up. But I took the synthesizer and the drummer of the Rich Kids, and we came up with the idea of putting together our favorite musicians from various bands, one of which was Billy Curry from Ultravox, and back Rusty's friend Steve Strange, and we put Visage together, which is a huge hit, Fade to Grey. Through working on Visage, I saw Ultravox, who were still a band at the time, saw them crumble and fall apart after a tour. They'd been dropped by the record company, the singer left, the guitarist left, and I ended up joining the three guys who were left. So, you know, we Ultravox was born out of working on the Visage project. Oh. So there's a linear path all the way through it, although it looks like you're dipping your toe in a lot of different genres of music. I don't know any musician who says, you know, I am this, and they categorize it absolutely like a book in a library.
Yeah.
You know, I belong in that category and will never vary from there. You know, these days everything's about crossover, and people are quite honest about it. Music's either good or bad. It doesn't really matter what categorization you put on it. And most musicians don't put their own categorization on it.
No.
It's the media who do that.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a bit like Roxy Music, so we put it in that category, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it goes in that, ticks
of course,
that box,
yeah.
You know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, whether it's synth pop, like you said, or punk, you've always created such original sounds. And I mean, am I right in thinking that once you were asked to join the Sex Pistols?
I was, but I didn't know they were called the Sex Pistols at the time. It was Malcolm McLaren who was in Glasgow back in 84. 85, 86, oh, so 75, 76. Mm-hmm. And I was chatting to this very odd-looking character who was telling me about his past and his involvement with the New York Dolls and his involvement with the shop that was making clothes and you know, Vivian Westwood, this fashion designer. Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he was putting this band together, and of course the band turned out to be the Sex Pistols. But after half an hour of conversation, he only then asked if I was a musician, and I thought, well, this is just wrong. This doesn't make any sense at all.
Sling it in at the end, you know.
Yeah, at the end. They stopped me because I had short hair, you know. They stopped me because I had the kind of James Dean haircut, which was, you know, the opposite of what everyone else looked like at the time. So.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. When someone says something, you never know what it's going to become, and would it have become that if you were in it or they were in it? You never know.
He picked absolutely the right people. You know, the Pistols were the Pistols because of the combination of characters, because of Glenn Matlock's musicality, you know, because of, you know, Lydon's great character and, you know, aggression and manner and humour and all of that.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have been the Pistols if I was in the band.
That's
and I wouldn't have been an Ultravox. And therefore, I suppose Band-Aid would never have happened. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. We'd all been sadder for it. But I mean, talking of being in, you know, in concert, I was delighted to see you last year at Hampton, in Hampton Court. And you mentioned your favourite song. One of your favourite songs is No Regrets. Is that one of your favourites or sort of the only favourite? And what makes it so special?
I have lots of. I don't think anyone's got one favourite song. It's very difficult because there are so many different, you know, genres and different time periods that music has been great. There's been a lot of grey area where it's not been particularly interesting to me. But there's so many great songs out there that, as a writer, when you've done something new, you think, oh, fabulous, I'm really pleased with that, until you hear someone who's much, much better than you, and you think, oh, I've still got a mountain to climb when it comes to that, to try and be as good as that.
All right, hard on yourself.
But no, it's absolutely true. I don't think you ever stop. I don't think you ever hit that plateau and think, that's the best song I could ever write.
Mm.
You know, the drive is to write something better than you've written before and write it in a more interesting way.
Yes. I mean, when you're talking about writing songs, have you found any that instantly have sort of just come to you and written themselves in about 2 minutes, and others that have just been a real bit of a slog?
Oh, most of them are a slog, I have to say. There's a couple that spring to mind. There's a song I dreamt, a song called Dear God, and it was a very simplistic, like a child's prayer, but with a kind of barbed edge to it, you know, so it's saying, you know, Dear God, is there somebody out there?
Yeah.
But you can read it as a child's prayer that way, or you could read it as an exclamation, Dear God, is there somebody out there?
Yeah, help me.
Just an exasperation.
Yes.
And I dreamt this, and most time when you dream a tune, by the time you've woken up in the morning, you've completely forgotten it. It's completely gone. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
Even if you sing it in a little tape recorder at the side of the, a little dictaphone thing at the side of the bed, it just doesn't make sense to you in the morning. But this one did. So all I had to do was go to the studio and pop in and start kind of laying down what I heard and tweak it a little bit. And without thinking about it, I'd written a song that I was very pleased with. But a lot of the other times, it's a hard graft. You've got to try and write the lyrics that make sense, that have the imagery that you want to depict. Sometimes it's about the choice of the words, the sound of the word that helps the flow of the song. And of course, you realise that as you're writing it, you think, oh, people are going to read this on the liner notes. That's a bit too intimate. It's a bit like wearing your heart on your sleeve, or, you know, running down the street naked. People are going to see this. Do I really want to say that?
Yeah.
And of course, you wrangle in your head and think, okay, well, yeah, I do. And that's, if I'm a writer, I've got to be honest about what I write.
Yeah, it literally is exposing yourself in that sort of sense, exposing your feelings and your take on the world.
Laying yourself bare, I
well,
think.
Well, absolutely, yes. Obviously, you won't be naked, but you are going to be appearing in concert very shortly, I understand.
I am. I'm playing. I've got dates right between now and the end of the year, which take me all over in all sorts of different formats. I'm doing acoustic shows. I'm doing festival shows. This weekend, I'm up in Perth in Scotland, right in the heart of the beginning of the Highlands. It's a stunning setting.
Perfect weekend
in a place
for
called
it.
Sc- Gone Castle, and it's one of those 80s rewind packages with a whole wealth of bands on for the entire weekend.
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
And 50 or 60,000 people basking in the sunshine.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Going to be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, they're very much always sold out, those festivals. So it's
hugely popular.
Yeah.
Hugely popular, because people just go there and they know that, without even knowing who's playing, they know that they're going to see something that they're going to love.
Absolutely. And you'll be singing along as well, know every single lyric, you know. Just
yeah, unlike me.
Yeah, that can help you out if you get stuck. Oh, well, that's absolutely brilliant. And of course, you got the new album out. Of course,
Fragile. It seems to be doing very well. So I'm extremely happy that it's getting, as I said, the reaction and the response it's getting.
Yeah, that's no surprise. It's absolutely fantastic. And I look forward to playing some more on the show a little bit later. So just leaves me to say it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Midge.
Well, thank you very much.
And I do wish you lots of success with the new album, Fragile. And thank you so much for being on the show.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And that was the exceptionally talented Midge Ure.